This week's major spoilers podcast goes out to the following fine and faithful spoilerettes: Joao Brazil, Russell Radcliffe, Eric Trevarthen, James Thatcher, Tony Bishop, the Bishop, Jack Brown, Jason Martin, Tavis Easthope, Richard White, Silas Garrett, Evan Lewis, James Carver, Zachariah McAllister, founder of Springfield, Henry Lamont, Jared Agan, Derek Viger, Stephen Howland, Randy Mucha, Ben Acton, Craig Borden, Christian Mohalali, Jeanette Briggs, Mark Burbach, Jason Foreman, and Hunter Graham. Fine and faithful spoilerites all, we'd love to have your name join them in the hallowed ranks of spoilerosity. So point your internet shuttles to the docking bay there at members.majorspoilers.com and allow a future Major Spoilers production to go out to you.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Zach.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, it's time for Major Spoilers Cast. We'll read comics from the past, make some points, and get back sassed, and we'll hope you'll have a blast, the Major Spoilers Cast. Come join this feller, Steven, and a couple other nerds. Rodrigo's smart and thoughtful, and the fat one likes big words. We try not to sound stupid or go way off the track, but sometimes geeks can talk for weeks, just yak and yak and yak. The Major Spoilers Cast. Our quality cannot be surpassed. Comics, film, and other junk, and we'll always bring the funk. We're Major Spoilers. London Broilers. Houston Oilers. Major Spoilers Cast! Also, there's Zach.
Welcome to issue 575 of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing this episode with a friend. Hey, do us a favor. Head over to majorspoilers.com. And if you're going to buy something from Amazon, click on that Amazon.com button. Go over to Amazon, make your purchase. A little bit comes back our way and helps us do shows like this week after week after week. You know who's not going to be doing something in the near future? Edgar Wright. He's not going to be working on that Ant-Man series or that Ant-Man movie.
He's off.
For Marvel Studios. What's going on with that, Zach?
So it kind of just hit right before the holiday weekend that Edgar Wright and Marvel Studios would be parting ways, and he would no longer be the director of said Ant-Man movie, and Marvel would be in search of a new director, not announced yet, but will certainly be happening shortly. Not a whole lot was said, really. Besides,
that it was amicable.
Artistic differences based on the two parties. And Wright's been working on Ant-Man really, he's been trying to push this for like 5 years, trying to get this made. He's made sizzle reels to show what he could do with the property, and then it finally got picked up with Paul Rudd attached. I'm disappointed that Edgar Wright's not going to be involved anymore. Some rumors swirled around that it was possible script rewrites based on what Edgar Wright had written, I think, with one other co-writer. And the rumor is that giant Marvel continuity people need things to mishmash to make giant movies. So,
yeah, which makes complete sense with what they're doing now with the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's been working on this for 5 years, he's had that story in place. We saw that teaser that he did. It was like 2 years ago,
over two years ago
that we saw that, or people at Comic-Con saw that, and then it has leaked online.
And then people got to see it for about 20 minutes.
So it doesn't surprise me that there could be creative differences, especially if you're trying to create something that's this, your own little unique thing. Well, in the Marvel universe, your own little unique thing just doesn't stand.
And Edgar Wright has a very distinctive style.
Right.
A style that might not mesh with other stuff. I mean, Branagh did Thor, but his style is not necessarily a visual thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it lends itself to Thor, and I thought it worked well. And, we watched Thor the Dark World not too long ago, and I did watch Thor again with my son as he moves through this Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right.
There is a bit of a difference between the two films, but directing style is not too different between the two.
No.
And you really wouldn't be able to tell that it's two different directors pushing the actors forward.
I don't know
if this, if this could change things with Paul Rudd, if that means that he may now have second thoughts about being Ant-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel says, hey, don't worry. You're still going to get this, July 17th, 2015.
Right.
So sit back, fans, and hold on to your seat because it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Matthew, you have some thoughts on this?
Well, you have to imagine that a lot of the prep work is done. There's certainly a script at this point. In theory, someone should be able to just kind of step in. And if somebody at Marvel, whether that be, you know, production, whether that be somebody in a what do you call that, overseer role that like Jeff Johns has at DC, if they have an idea of what they want to do, it may be a question of getting a director who's willing to do that. Mm-hmm. I will say it's a shame that we don't get to see an Edgar Wright Ant-Man movie. Because to me, Marvel is the company that kind of started on, you know, weird eclectic ideas, and Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Stan Lee and, you know, Steve Ditko and Stan Lee and Don Heck just kind of going, let's see what cool things we can stick on the page.
Well,
but, you know, it is 60 years later, and I understand that you can't always do that in a movie kind of setting, I think, which is kind of the reason I prefer old comics. But that's not
it. Well, it's interesting because we are seeing history repeat itself in a lot of ways, assuming that the rumors are right. We are seeing, you know, Marvel Studios, a place for cool directors and like an eclectic mix of directors and artists and basically people involved in these movies can come in and make these movies their own. And that actually expands to Marvel in general. You know, Marvel superhero movies were kicked off by Spider-Man, which was directed by, I mean,
Sam Raimi.
The prototype is Blade.
Right.
But it was really kicked off by Spider-Man, which was directed by Raimi. And you can tell from 16 miles away that it's a Raimi movie.
Oh, yeah.
Just because of how swish-panned you get.
Yeah.
But now that they're trying to bring the universe and make it cohesive, each time you make a movie, you actually remove a little piece of potential from that universe.
But see, that's the weird thing. I mean, when you see Captain America: The Winter Soldier, it is a big departure stylistically from the other Marvel movies. It is not happy-go-lucky Iron Man. It is not, otherworldly aliens fighting with one another. Mm. It's a deep espionage movie, which is not necessarily, I mean, it fits within this piece, but it is not, it's not following the Iron Man, Thor, first Captain America tone in its shift. And certainly when we have Guardians of the Galaxy coming up, which is coming off as a big comedy, action comedy.
Right. But that's the previews.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily know if that's going to be the case. And I agree that thematically, Winter Soldier was very different, but visually it wasn't. And I wonder if the issues don't come down to the visuals. If Wright wanted to do Scott Pilgrim, and I mean, it's kind of dumb to say, well, he wanted to like throw in video game visuals and blah, 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 because he didn't. He was very good about creating that world of Scott Pilgrim. But what I'm saying is maybe he had something in mind. And when they looked at it, they said, this doesn't look like the Cosmic Cube. This doesn't look like the Chitauri. This doesn't look like, you know, whatever.
I mean, we've got a lot of actors cast. We've got Paul Rudd, as you said, is not playing Hank Pym. He's playing
Scott Lang.
And then we've got Michael Douglas playing Hank Pym. And then we have who's the Pym's daughter or whoever that Lang is involved with. Who's the female actress that's been cast in that?
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
All right. Doesn't matter.
Okay.
But, I mean, we are well into close to production. I mean, if this movie is supposed to come out in 2015.
Oh, it's Evangeline Lilly.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, her.
That movie's got to be shooting right now. I mean, they've got to be shooting stuff right now if they're going to have it done, and all the post work, because the post work is going to take 3 to 6 months to get done.
Yeah.
So they've got 30 to 90 days. They have from like now until December to shoot this movie. And then they've got 3 months to put all the visuals in and get the hype machine going in time for this 2015 release.
Yeah. It's in, I mean,
this
it's interesting.
This is like the, you know, losing your main actor the day before you're supposed to start shooting.
I think what Marvel's doing now with their hype machine, and is, you could see it a lot in Guardians of the Galaxy, is they're starting to cut trailers before their visuals are completely done at all.
Yeah.
And they show comparisons of the first Guardians teasers and what we're seeing now, and same scenes, but they're shot, I mean, the lit completely different with the grading, and more visual effects are being thrown in. So they're not finishing things before they're
I think maybe it was the first Captain America, or maybe it was Thor 2. They were still doing stuff like a week out before. I mean, the day of the U.S. premiere, they were still dumping stuff into it. And the nice thing is you don't have to send it out to the printers to have it printed on miles and miles of film anymore. It goes right out to the hard drive and dropped in, and then it beams out to wherever that you're sending it to. Although I think they still deliver it in hard drive form.
Which is
They get it in both ways. They either have a code to download it, or they get them in hard drives.
Okay.
Which is really heartening in a way that nowadays there is a guy much like me sitting at Marvel Studios waiting for something to render for 17 hours.
Yeah. Or whoever they're dealing
with. Video producers take heart.
I was involved with a little education thing, and the host of that is a guy that does a lot of the bits for Saturday Night Live, not the live stuff, but the pre-recorded stuff, the stuff that they actually go out and film, like Dick in a Box and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And he walked through the whole process of how they go from shoot to edit to air, and it's like he gets a script on Monday in Los Angeles. He flies out on Wednesday to scout locations and to walk everything through. Mm-hmm. Then they shoot everything on Thursday and Friday. And by the time they're done, it is like 2 a.m. on Saturday morning. And then they are post-producing, color correcting, affecting it all the way until
air.
Literally airtime. It is like 20 minutes before air when they have to have their thing posted.
I saw some of those guys were putting their edit timelines online a couple weeks ago from one of the Beyonce skits they did, and they showed they were doing time codes of when they were uploading certain things, and there was a dress rehearsal cut, a show cut, and that aired. They got that done like 10 minutes before it aired, and then they do they finish it after the show's already done to upload it on the web. So it's not even completely done yet before they upload it.
Yeah, it's crazy. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I would want a little bit more prep time to get stuff done, especially if this one kicks off the third wave, or is Guardians of the Galaxy's kick off the third wave?
Technically, I think Ant-Man does, because it's after Avengers. Yeah.
So if this is kicking off your third wave and you want it to go well,
There is nothing about this that's good.
No.
You know, sometimes maybe we'll get, you know, the true person that was always destined to direct this movie after all. But this did not happen for a good reason. This throws the movie into a tailspin, and it's going to take a lot of work for
somebody
this movie
who's very creative
to pull it out.
Yeah, if there hasn't been a complete script rewrite, and as long as the actors are still on board, and as long as your shoot schedule is going on, a new director can step in pretty quickly, get up to speed on the material, and move things along without a huge catastrophic change. But I mean, it's still
it's gonna be something.
You're going
to
be.
They were doing their principal shooting was supposed to start like this summer. Was what they had. I read that on Major Spoilers.
Well, summer starts in less than 20 days.
That's what Steven's doing, is they got to start shooting. Or that's what Steven was saying, is they got to start shooting now.
I bet we get an announcement of director, and that week they're shooting.
Today's Tuesday.
Yep.
Wednesday is usually a day that they make their big movie announcements. We already have word that Daredevil has been cast for the Netflix series. Yeah. It's a rumor, hasn't been officially announced. I'm going to bet Wednesday or Thursday that will drop. No later than Friday this week, we'll find out who the director is on Daredevil.
Mm, yeah. And the interesting thing about this story is that the next day, the director, writer, executive producer for the Daredevil series backed out so he could focus more on Sony's The Sinister Six.
Six, yeah.
And that one seemed more premeditated because they announced his replacement the next day.
Right.
And Edgar Wright still hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it wasn't as clean.
He posted something on Twitter and then took it down immediately. And, of course, some people have already captured it.
Yeah, sure.
But it's a shot of Buster Keaton sitting alone, looking sad and holding one of the,
Coronado ice
cream. Yeah, Coronado ice cream wrappers.
Mm-hmm.
And he put it up with no commentary and then took it back down a little bit later. And many people are speculating that the real message is Buster Keaton got screwed over when he sold out to the studios. and he wasn't allowed to do all the things that he used to do when he was running everything himself. Mm-hmm. And many are speculating that that is Edgar Wright saying the exact same thing about how he went with Marvel, how he had this great idea. A lot of people were behind it. And then all this creativity and control was taken away from
it. I know Whedon, Joss Whedon posted a picture on Twitter after it happened that he had one of the Coronado ice creams and he was like holding above his head with his head down and like solidarity with Edgar Wright or something.
Well, and that's interesting too, because it seems like Joss has the, not the final say in everything that goes on in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but he's the one that's kind of plotting out the big, the big points. So I don't know. Interesting. Like I said, we'll know more about, we'll know more about the Daredevil news tomorrow, I'm sure. But I do have a story up there about Charlie Cox, who many of you know from Boardwalk Empire, been cast as Daredevil for the for that Netflix series. The other thing that's kind of surprising is Graphically announced that it is basically shutting down, moving its key employees over to a new self-publishing platform called Blurb. None of the assets are coming over, said Mika Baldwin, who is the co-founder of Graphically. I don't think people who have Graphically accounts have been told. I guess they have 30 days or something like that to get their stuff, download it, and then it's gone.
Jeez.
Off the digital reader. So again, that is just another reason why we are only renting our digital comics and we do not own them.
Yeah.
So we'll have more on that throughout the week. So there you go. And you can find out more news over at majorspoilers.com. And don't forget, you can find us at Nerdtacular 2014 in Salt Lake City, Utah, really Snowbird Resort. It's just up the mountain from Salt Lake. You can, actually look off the mountain down into the valley. Mm-hmm. And it's a long ways down.
It is.
We're going to have a lot of fun there. We hope to see you there. You can find out more at nerdtacular.com. The rooms are filling up quickly. I think that there are only a few tickets left. So if you want to go, you better get on it today because it's going to be sold out. And I know that they have more people expected to attend than they have in the past. So a lot of great panels that are going to be there. Go check it out at nerdtacular.com. Okay, let us take a look at some comic book reviews. Let's see. Looks like everybody's got some eclectic titles this week. For me, I've got Cowl, C-O-W-L, number one from Image Comics, the Chicago Organized Workers League. It's the world's first superhero labor union. And so this story takes place, I want to say, in like the late 60s, early 70s. And I think it's late 60s. I don't have the issue open here in front of me. This was a review copy sent to us by Image Comics. Comes out this week. And you can see the crime fighters working together, but you also realize that in the background there is a labor dispute going on as whether their contract to protect the city of Chicago will be renewed or not. And there's some implications that the big bad guy that they took down went rogue from the labor union organization, and some people in the issue are speculating that it was a setup, that he did this so that they could sign the contract and move forward. Others are suspecting some other greater nefarious goings on. This is really cool. And I want to say that there was a Vimeo or YouTube short, or maybe it's up on iTunes, a short that I want to say is like Cowl, but it was a labor union for superheroes. Like a year ago, I think, is when I saw it. I didn't have time to look it up today. But it seemed very familiar and very similar to this. So it's really good. The art in this thing by Alex Siegel. Holy crap. It's almost a little bit like watercolor, but it's a little bit more detailed than some of the stuff that we saw in like Arkham Asylum, which is really kind of watercolored out and spread all out. All the characters have a very unique look, but it's very muted tones like you would see in a watercolor painting. I just love the art. It's a departure from things that we've seen before. There's some great character development that's going on in this first issue. I'm pretty sure this is going to be a mini series. I really can't see it going beyond six issues. And with Image Comics, it seems like it's either four or six issues for this. But Cowl number one really captured my attention. You can get it for $3.50 or, and this is what I like about Image Comics, you can go to their website. You can get the digital DRM free version of this for $2.99. So 50 cents off. You're not paying that fee to Comixology or to one of the other other groups like Graphically. This is a good series, and I think you should pick up at least the first issue. I'm giving this one 4 out of 5 slices of meatloaf. That's Cowl number one out this week from Image Comics. Matthew.
Hi. How are you?
I am fine.
My name is Matthew. I read comics, and this week I picked up Dark Horse Comics, Axe Cop, The American Choppers, number one. And if you've actually heard me talk about Axe Cop, you know that this is kind of an unusual series in that it started as a webcomic. That's not the unusual part. It's about a vicious, you know, psychopath, which really most comics are. So that's not the weird part. But it is written by what I believe is now a 10-year-old boy, Malachi Nicole, drawn by his older brother, Ethan. And Axe Cop has long been kind of a stream of consciousness comic book story. And it's really been awesome. It's just basically the imagination of a child going, woohoo, woohoo, woohoo. Now, I have a 10-year-old of my own. And I've discovered something sad about 10-year-olds. 10-year-olds try to grow up and try to be adults. So as I'm reading Axe Cop American Choppers, number one, I'm trying not to be sad that, you know, Malachi is growing up. We pick up the story where the last episode or issue of Axe Cop left. Axe Cop had been elected president of the world. And he's now quitting because he wants to dress up as a cop. And he's decided to just be the president of fighting from now on. So Axe Cop and his pet dinosaur Wexter take off into the world and leave his new wife as the president of the world. She's also the queen of water. And he goes off to find new adventures and discovers that there's an evil gang, the Food Force 5, with chop-proof uniforms. And so he runs into another guy called Captain Axe. Captain Axe, by the way, is clearly not Captain America, even though he has a shield and a red, white, and blue motif. He clearly has an axe and also chops people's heads off. There's a lot of head chopping in this issue. But Axe Cop discovers that because of his new friend, Captain Axe, he wants to form a super team. And so he gives his pet dog an axe, and his dog becomes Axe Dog. And they attach axe blades to a goat who becomes Axe Goat. And his ex-girlfriend, Axe Girl, comes back and brings her mom, Axe Mom, along with her. And they form the American Choppers, which is a kind of a clever pun. And also there's a goat with an axe on fire on his side. So how can you not love this? As the issue ends, though, we discover that even though Axe Cop defeated all the bad guys in the universe, he didn't defeat the demon lumberjacks from hell. And also, his latest axe may possibly be evil in trying to kill him. It's one of those things where sometimes you reach that point of diminishing returns with a joke, and it just feels like you're about to get to the point where it's all going to be just Community Season 4, telling you how clever you are for remembering what happened in Community Season 1 through 3. We are not at this point in American Choppers number 1. However, the sad, cynical part of my brain can see that point from here. I like this issue. It's as well drawn as the others, and it has those wonderful moments of, oh no, what do we do? I know, everybody press all your buttons at once. It's not working. Well, we have to do it at exactly the same time and get the ones up there. And then, of course, the atomic homing missiles fly out and everyone is destroyed in atomic fire. It's fun. It's imaginative. It's goofy. But I may be overthinking it in that I worry that the writer is starting to grow up and starting to become an adult and maybe even starting to understand the classical rules of drama and storytelling, which does make me a little sad. Even so, Axe Cop, American Choppers, number one, 3.5 slices of meatloaf. It's still funny. It's still fun. Plus dinosaur with machine guns for arms. I mean, that right there, Rodrigo bought 3 copies while we were talking and he didn't even know it.
Yeah, no, I have it on auto buy on Comixology. Yeah,
anything that the keyword dinosaur pops up.
Keyword dinosaur, keyword on fire. So... keyword Axe jumping goat out of an airplane.
Awesome. He's got blades on his antlers. See his goat horns.
Nice. Now, yeah. Honestly, Matthew, from the moment, like, I basically had 2 rapid fire reactions when I heard the premise, like the idea behind Axe Cop. you know, that it's actually this little boy writing it and his brother drawing it. The first one was, that's amazing. And the second one was, what are they going to do when he grows up?
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, yep. he's 10 years old now. I'm sure the stories have changed, but eventually he's going to be 16. And, you know, then the stories yeah. will have to make sense because they're being written by somebody who understands what comics are like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
or maybe not.
It does make you sad.
It'll be interesting when he hits 14 maybe. Or 12 and yeah, discovers yeah. girls, and then suddenly everything will change.
Yeah. I mean, who
not
knows?
Not everybody discovers yeah. girls when they're 12. Some people get a little older. But, yeah, it is one of those things where I worry every issue that things might be making – and this is the strangest thing I've said about comics. Things might be making it too much sense.
Yeah.
Maybe Axel will go to high school.
Could be. 21 Jump Street.
Yeah. It would be 21 Jump
Street. 21 Chop Street.
There you go.
All right, so 3.5 slices of meatloaf for that. Yes. Rodrigo.
Yes, hello.
Speaking of things that are disturbing.
Uh-huh.
Clowns.
Yes. So I picked up Beyond, : The Man Who Laughs from Blue Water. I think the Beyond is a series.
Okay. Because it threw me for a loop. I had to search for it.
Right, right.
Beyond the Man.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right.
I could have just done the Amy Winehouse book.
Ugh.
But
no, thanks.
And I might touch on that here momentarily. So The Man Who Laughs is a book that is kind of a treatise on clowns, fear of clowns, people that have played clowns, and this presumed like curse of the clown kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why that sounds really convoluted is because there is in fact not enough of anything to kind of support anything in this book. So they kind of just throw a bunch of stuff together. It all kind of hinges together on the story of Heath Ledger, who died towards the end of production of The Dark Knight. Right. So, if you've seen the information that came out of it, we kind of know that it wasn't the Joker that killed Heath Ledger, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this book is like, so is there a curse? And then, like, a couple pages later, they talk about the other really two major prominent actors who have played the Joker,
yeah.
who were perfectly fine.
Caesar
Romero and Jack Nicholson. And they talk about them. Jack Nicholson, still out there making movies. Not only that, but it's not like, you know, Caesar Romero, they talk about the Joker like maybe typecasting him.
Mm-hmm.
But Jack Nicholson even broke out of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's no... also, Cesar Romero, a guy who was so much bigger than the Joker that he wouldn't shave his mustache.
Right, right.
To put the paint on. So, again, there's a lot... like, there's some cool stuff in this book. Clearly, a lot of research, a surprising amount of research mm-hmm. went into it. You know, they talk about, like, Grimaldi and stuff like that, like ancient clowns and, like, kind of like the people that started typifying that clown look and the problems that they ran into. The whole book is narrated by this character. Let me see if I can find what his name is. Virgil Hall. Which I thought is like, oh, this might just literally be the author, but it's actually written by Valerie D'Orazio. So it's not. So here's the thing. Here's probably the most frustrating thing about this book is that if it was fictionalized, if they just took all of these little things and put them in a fictional universe and said, there's this clown curse and this Virgil Hall guy is the only one who's been able to put it together, this would actually be an interesting fiction book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of neither, unfortunately. On the one hand, it's kind of a documentary about people who have played clowns, and sometimes bad things happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not enough evidence of anything to kind of put together any sort of cohesive, even fake, crazy ancient aliens type hypothesis. I mean, there's like not enough bad things happen to people who play clowns. And on the other side, it kind of talks about all these like ancient trickster figures and really pulls like, I mean, it talks about like Eshu and it also talks about Bugs Bunny and stuff. And like putting Bugs Bunny in the same category as the Joker, like, yeah, he's a prankster character.
Right.
But it's kind of not the same thing. There's a lot of stuff where it's just like, it's like a lot of it is a stretch. But if she had just put it in a fictionalized world and filled in the gaps with fake things that she made up,
yeah, mm-hmm.
this could actually be the really a really solid start to a book. So I'm gonna go ahead and give this guy, this book, 1.5 slices of meatloaf, because it's not very good. There's not a lot there except a lot of actually pretty decent seeds that could be taken somewhere else, either as a much bigger treatise of what it is to play a clown and the problems that that causes you. And you can go into depression and career and like what it does to your career when you're a clown character. Go into a lot of like women comedians, like a lot of the like your early television, like 40s, 50s and 60s women who were kind of like clownified in order to not be threatening, mm-hmm. and stuff like that to the male comedian kind of thing. There's a lot of room there. Or what I would actually want this to be is a fictionalized account. Start with a Heath Ledger like character dying and weave this like completely non-existent in reality, but very compelling Curse of the Clown.
Yeah.
And actually make it a book. So that's kind of like, if I don't know if the author is listening, but if they are, do that. Just take all the good stuff out of here, mm-hmm. which there is.
Well, that's why
and make it that.
Well, that's what I first wanted to look up and see if she had done any kind of, because you know, a lot of the comic conventions they will have, or just conventions in general, they will have poster presentations or presentations on the psychology of the Joker and these kinds of things. But if this is the same person, she's actually got a pretty good comic writing career, having worked for Acclaim Comics on The Tick and Shadow Man and Magnus Robot Fighter, and then over at DC Comics with Catwoman, Batman, New Frontier, Identity Crisis, doing a lot of stuff with that. And I think she's now working or was working on something with Marvel.
She's the occasional superhero.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really surprised that this is coming out from her.
And you know what?
If it is the same person.
But again, Blue Water has these series, right? Fame.
Right.
Probably this one, Beyond, all these other ones. And they probably were like, okay, we're looking for a writer to write this. And this is probably very much a freelance gig, even more so than your usual comic gig.
Right.
So, but I'm saying is this, I think this person is talented because she got a lot more interesting stuff out of your usual Blue Water fare.
Well, yeah, that's good.
So I'm saying like, there's something here. There's actually something here. So either Blue Water having the rights to this, go find this person again and be like, actually write this book, or Valerie, like having done this already as a warm up, start writing this book. Or, you know, if you're happy just working for Marvel right now, do that. But put this in the back burner because there's something to this.
Cool. All right.
Cool, man.
Zach, what's going on in the world of the Red Panda?
The Red Panda is finishing up its 2-part stories, One Tin Soldier, where we find the Red Panda and its trusty sidekick trying to find down Captain Clockwork. And that is all this issue is about. And so look, I guess the best way to frame this is, the Mask of the Red Panda is an ongoing podcast, old style radio show, with a lot of continuity kind of built into it.
A lot of continuity built into it
right now. So, I didn't realize about this about the comic, but the author,
Greg Taylor,
did a villain profile at the end of this, and he talks about Captain Clockwork. And how it hit the idea of it kind of started, where it was a throwaway line he had by the chief of police say something about one day a bunch of clockwork soldiers will attack the town. It's a completely throwaway line. And Taylor talks about that he just kind of throws these in homages to old comic books he used to read as a kid because he never got to read a full run. And so there's always just these pieces he never got to find out the full story of. So he started throwing these in the clock to Mask the Red Panda. And so people started demanding. And then he finally threw Captain Clockwork in there at one point. Now,
yeah, not too long ago. Right. I think it was New Year's or something.
And so, but what he addresses is the Night of the Red Panda happens in the interstitials mm-hmm. of the throwaway references between the show. And actually, we haven't even got to the point where the show starts yet in World War II. So everything that's happening in the comics is leading up to this. So we can't get a full story out of this, really. So essentially what happens in this story is Masquerade Panda teams up with the sidekick again. They find a couple clockwork robot guys, lead him back to Capital Clockwork. The actual, his robot, becomes semi-sentient mm-hmm. and goes against his creator, which apparently has happened in one of the
yes.
recent episodes. But the Captain Clockwork gets away. And that's the end of this. That's the end of this two-part story. And then we're going to tease to what next part that's coming. So it felt incomplete and not like a whole story. Like I kind of got cheated mm-hmm. when I read the 15 or so pages of this story. And then I got to the profile Taylor wrote. Like, oh, okay, this is actually really cool because you get an insight into Taylor, the creation of the comic and the podcast in the show. Right. And you kind of see an inside look of what his mindset is creating this huge overall arcing story yeah. through these two mediums.
Now, does he say what episodes this story takes place between? Does it say this no. takes place between episodes this and this, or well, this story and this story of the Dakota Ring Theater?
This is all taking place before the show started.
Oh, before the very first episode yeah. of the show. Okay, yeah. okay.
So that's where we're at right now.
Okay, I thought you meant... Okay.
Yeah, and then he kind of alludes to future issues will take place in between the throwaway lines where he talks about battling some character.
Mm-hmm.
Much like Captain Clockwork, I guess, was kind of seeded throughout. You don't actually see Captain Clockwork very much in the episode. He doesn't get a lot of face time, he just gets a lot of mentions and mm-hmm. stuff. And so I thought that, I honestly thought Taylor's last three pages he wrote was worth 99 cents. And mm-hmm. then it was nice because the 14 pages leading the actual comic story were completely worth it, I thought. And they were nice. And I thought the art has gotten a lot better. And I thought there's still that kind of old timey coloring palette, which isn't completely consistent like we saw when we were the trade paperback. Right. They kind of did the shadowing kind of weird. It's still here, but it's not as drastic anymore. And so I'm really on board with the art right now too. But then I was looking through all the extras. Good friend of the show, Thomas Perkins actually yeah. has art in the back of this
yes.
issue.
Mm-hmm. He's done the cover. They've yeah. had a couple of
novels,
and mm-hmm. he's done the art for them.
Yeah, yeah, and so he has some other art in here. And man, if Perkins could do a whole issue of Masquerade Panda, that would be super
yeah,
awesome.
It would be pretty awesome. Yeah,
it'd be great. So I'm even though I felt shortchanged at first. It's kind of hard to feel shortchanged 99 cents, and then I read all the extras, and I was completely felt worth the 99 cents. So I'm going to give this 4 out of 5 slices of meatloaf.
Cool. Excellent. That's out this week. All of these comics out this week. Or Beyond Joker, Man of Laughs, I don't think is out until June, if I remember correctly. It's down the road a ways. But I do want to go back and fill in some information about Cowl number 1. While everyone was talking, I did look it up. The movie came out in 2008. It's called The League. And it is actually a story that takes place before The Cowl. It's by the exact same creators. Kyle Higgins, Alex Siegel created this movie back in 2008. It's about a 30-minute look at the rise of the first superhero league. The thing that threw me was it's got a different name in the comic book than it does in the movie. But the two are exactly tied together because it's got the same characters in it and everything. It just takes place 20 years later. Because of that, instead of being a cheap knockoff of a movie, I want to raise this to 5 slices of meatloaf because they do tie it in and they do make it a continuity from a very obscure movie that probably few people have seen. But I did like The League. It is worth checking out. You can go get that on iTunes and you can find out even more reviews over at majorspoilers.com. And while you're over there, you might want to consider checking out some of our ads, tweakedaudio.com. Glad to have them as a sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to get Rodrigo a pair of headphones earlier yeah. while we were starting up the show, and the headphones were a complete mess. Not so with Tweaked Audio mm-hmm. headphones, but they're thin ribbon design. Those things don't get tangled. And if you did try to tie it in a knot, it just comes right out very quickly, very easily. No tangle, no hassle, no fuss. I love these earbuds from tweakedaudio.com. Head over there. A lot of different colors, a lot of different styles to choose from. Best of all, when you use the checkout code MAJOR, you can get 33% off your price. And I'll give you a little heads up. Next week, we got a new sponsor coming on next week, and you're going to get 50% off their deal.
Woo!
So you'll want to go check them out. That's next week, a new sponsor coming on board.
Is it Popeye's Fried Chicken?
No, even better than Popeye's. Although if they want to be a sponsor, they can contact us at podcast@majorspoilers.com. But of course, a lot of reviews. And I need to get back a hold of Greg Taylor, because he and I were exchanging some emails not too long ago. I want to get him on our next, either our next one or two down the road interview shows that we have. I've got a comic creator. I think she just had her first comic work published. We all know her, and I'm going to be hopefully talking with her on the show in the near future, too. Cool. So that'll be fun.
Fantastic.
And you can, like I said, go check over majorspoilers.com. Lots of reviews over there, including news, videos, and, of course, the Major Spoilers poll of the week.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the poll of the week. Thank you.
So this week, I want to talk about your weekly budgets. Every once in a while, we go out and we try to do an impromptu poll, finding a little bit about our listeners, finding a little bit about you, but also just kind of getting a feel for where your what your spending habits are. What kind of things do you spend your money on and how much? And this week, I would like to know, how much do you spend on entertainment? And entertainment includes comics, games, movies, toys, whatever, each week. Rodrigo, how much do you spend each week? I mean, you could calculate in how much does your Netflix cost per week? How much does your, you know, all that stuff? Because that's what I did.
Yeah.
I calculated all that in an average week.
Yeah, I think for me, it's probably going to be that 0 to 20.
Okay.
I don't spend a lot of money on stuff, but what ends up happening is that I will make a couple of major purchases a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then also just, you know, ongoing Netflix, D&D Insider kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So 0 to 20. Zach, what about you?
Yeah, I did Netflix and all that stuff, and then some Patreon stuff I do, so that comes out weekly. And then random stuff. Music I buy every once in a while. A new movie will come out, and I'll grab it really quick. But mainly it's right between 0 and 20 is where I kind of need to keep it. So that's that's where I'm at with that. And I'm okay with that.
I need to keep it between 0 and 20, but for me it's more like $200 because if I go to the movies, like the boy will go with me to the movie, so we'll see money there. You go do the iTunes stuff that we download, the movies to watch that, and the season stuff that we do, Legos that we get for the Lego builds that we do over at Major Spoilers Video at youtube.com/Major Spoilers Video. Also where you can find the want list, you know, the comic book purchases that I purchase. And I think I'm down to about, I want to say I'm down to less than 10 comics a week. There was a time where it was like 15, 20 comics a week, maybe more, 50 comics a week. But now I'm down to less than 10 a week. And physically, I'm down to 3 or 4 a week. So a majority of it's still coming from digital. Mm-hmm. But, you know, add all that stuff up, and that's about $200 a week that eats into my entertainment. Now, granted, I've got the ability to do that right now. But, yeah, that's where I'm sitting right now. I was kind of shocked when I started calculating in. How much is the Hulu Plus? How much is the Amazon Prime? How much is the Netflix? All the movies? Yeah. All of that other stuff. It adds up quickly. Matthew, what about you?
Well, I'm lucky in that the Amazon Prime and Netflix accounts in my house aren't out of my budget. But I do have – I got the big cable. I have the HBO and Cinemax package because I don't like people. So if I'm going to watch movies, I do it, you know, 18 months later in the comfort of my own couch. My comic book budget is defined by my hours at the store. Whatever I make at the comic shop is how much money I have to spend on comic books. And it's been that way for – gosh, probably 8 years now. That is my way of keeping my comic budget under control. It balances out. Whatever amount of money Dion gives me will come back to the store. So it's, you know, it's kind of a, honestly, maybe a self-destructive prophecy there. But I went with the 21 to 50 because per week, you know, when I'm looking at things like entertainment, there are times where we'll go out, you know, and Widget and I'll just show up at a store and be like, oh, look, let's buy that. And again, there are times when we can't do that. And, you know, today we ran around in circles and went to the little place that makes chocolate downtown. And I'm like, I didn't know whether to count that as entertainment or just being fat. So I figure, yeah, the 20 to 50 is about right if you average in my comics and internet and all the things that I don't you know, actually end up paying for it. Yeah.
Do you have a regular customer at your store? I mean, you don't have to name names. Do you have a regular customer at your store that spends $200 or more each week in comics?
We have a few. Yeah. I mean, you have those big cornerstone guys. The problem is it's cyclical.
Hmm.
If you have one of those guys for a year or more, you're lucky. There are guys who have huge pull lists. And then there are guys who have huge pull lists who have, you know, money problems flame out, and then you're stuck with a big pile of that guy's books. But yeah, there are people who spend that kind of money on comics and toys. And we do sell, you know, a lot of the games. We have the magic cards. Mm-hmm. If you take into account the guys coming in and buying, yeah, Chris does a lot of really good work on our back issue magic cards.
Mm-hmm.
Back issue is probably not the term. But, you know, that stuff will come in. You have people who will spend $100, $200. But, you know, you also have people who, when they have downtime, they go to the store.
Yeah.
And they play a pickup game. Or, right. You know, they're at the store because, well, it's not that it's the only place that they're loved, because I don't want to be mean or anything. But, you know, there are people who are at the store, and that is their social outlet. And in some cases, their only social outlet. They'll go, they'll buy the stuff, they'll talk to people about the movies, the games, whatever they do. So, yeah, those guys do exist, but we're starting to see more of them. I'm not going to go into any of the sociopolitics of Central Kansas, but I believe that the overall ability to have that kind of money to spend on external factors and, you know, unnecessary toys and games and comics is increasing slowly in the Topeka mm-hmm. area.
Yeah, no, that's really good. I mean, that's really good overall. I just, this last week, this new, I forgot that I'd ordered it, a new graphic novel by Paul Dini and Joe Quinones, Black Canary and Zatanna Bloodspell came in. And that's like that's a $22 book. So, you know, that, you know, you get a hardcover or something like that that's going to eat into mm-hmm. your budget. And that's what Rome says. I make a monthly trip to the comic book store, pick up my pull list, and browse the racks for anything else that looks interesting. My wife has long held me to a $50 a month budget, but if a cool new hardcover is being released, I'll usually splurge, but never more than $75 in a month. So I guess my weekly would be 0 to 20. And I'm hoping that everyone's remembering that it's not just comic books. It's, do you go to the movies? Do you buy the app game that you download mm-hmm. on your mobile device? Ingrid says,
do you cheat and buy the little thing on Candy Crush that gives you extra lives?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ingrid says, I lead a busy life. I have limited time for entertainment, although so it comes down to the occasional comic or air movie, spending a little on games, although I foresee some heavy spending on D&D books later this year. Andrea says, I'm just about the $20 mark, but the prizes here on the far side of the world are much, much higher. So it's, oh, the prices are much more like one trade. Alicia says, I pick the lowest 0 to 20. Mike Estep says, well, if you take a whole month and average it out, I'm probably in the 20 to 50 range. Dan says, I'm probably revealing this in the wrong environment. But comics, video games, toys, and other pieces of nerd culture will definitely take a backseat to records or live music on a weekly basis. Buying records and CDs definitely take a bigger chunk out of the weekly budget. But that counts, too. So so there you go. Topher says $50 a week or less. Cat Halo says 200 euros per month, which is about $270. MJ says, hey, Tiger, you've hit the jackpot. And Clever Lang says, they call me El Cheapo.
I pity him.
I try not to spend anything on entertainment. So there you go. Listeners, you can head over to MajorSpoilers.com. You can share your comments on your weekly budget, and you can check out the poll of the week. And the more people that get involved, the more accurate our data is. Not that we really do anything with it anyway. I just think it's kind of interesting to see trends, to see what people are interested in, to see where all of our listeners are and what they do, because it helps us fine tune and craft more content for you. And we want to thank everyone who's a VIP member. We want to thank everyone who's become a VIP member. With your support, you're helping us move further and further along and do more great content for you. I was counting it up today.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the lineup on the Major Spoilers podcast network.
Lay it on me, big man.
We have on Monday Munchkin Land. On Tuesday we do the Major Spoilers podcast. Wednesday is Dueling Reviews.
Yep.
Thursday we have Top Five. Friday we have Critical Hit. Zach on Film. Mm-hmm. Saturday is Critical Hit and the Want List Audio Edition. Sundays we have the Wayne's Comics podcast and the Want List video edition over at youtube.com/majorspoilersvideo. And man, we may just add one more just to round it up to an even 10.
Whoa.
Not from us necessarily, but I got to make a few phone calls and talk to a few people. But, you know, it's always good to expand that Major Spoilers podcast network. So 10, 9, maybe 10 shows a week.
Look at that.
That we get going on. And, of course, we've got Finally Friday coming up, too. I was busy this past week and didn't get that launched. And I've got to sit down and work out one technical bit so people can call in and interact on the show a little bit easier. But that's coming, too. So 11, maybe 11 things that's coming on. All thanks to our VIP members.
Beautiful show.
Okay, let us get into some Amazing Spider-Man action. This is the Marvel Masterworks Amazing Spider-Man Volume 5. This is all scripted by Stan Lee, pencils and co-plotted by John Romita Sr., although I don't know why it says that, because it's Ditko all over these pages.
Yeah, this is Romita.
Is it? Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought it was Ditko.
It's all Romita.
Oh, okay, okay. All right, so these are issues 41 through 50, plus... what is it, the Avengers Annual number 3, or is it the Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 3?
Spider-Man
Annual. So here we get stories about the Rhino.
Mm-hmm.
We get...
It's a lot of Rhino.
A lot of Rhino. And I got to say this, because I was reading this the other day, and reading up on the origin story of Rhino and how he's not a very smart person. And you read some of these lines that he says... And I just can't help but kind of thinking about that guy from the old Tennessee Tuxedo or Bullwinkle shows. It's like, why you Spider-Man? I'm going to smash you hard. You know, that's just kind of how he sounds. And every time you read one of his lines, you can almost hear him saying that. Ooh, Spider-Man, I hate you so much. I'm going to give you such a pinch. But
this is
some crazy Rhino action.
First appearance of the Rhino. First appearance.
Yes, in this set.
And I always hear him as having a thick Russian accent.
Well, and that's what they do in the movies. And I know that, doesn't he have an origin as Russian?
Yeah, his name is Alexei Sistovich.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always think of him as, and it's kind of that moment where you're just like, might be a tiny bit offensive. I always hear it as that 60s thing of, oh, he's this Russian guy who doesn't speak English very well, and they're making fun of him Jose Jimenez on the Jack Benny show.
Yeah. No, I just...
So kind of offensive.
If you make him comical, though, I think he comes off quite crazy like that. Did you like the Rhino stories, or were those just too weird? I mean, we're doing a chemical bond upon you, and now you have a skin as thick as a rhino's, and you got a horn on your head.
This is classic Marvel.
Good luck.
I mean... This is like that kind of like crazy pseudoscience. Let's just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And since
everything sticks,
and since it's Stan Lee doing it, it's mostly animal based.
Yes.
Yes, you're right. Pretty much everything sticks. Everything's given the same amount of treatment. Like, in these stories, you know, the Rhino has come to actually be a very comical Spider-Man villain. In modern representations, the Rhino doesn't get taken too seriously. For example, super-duper spoiler alert, you know, in the movie, he's in Amazing Spider-Man 2, he's pretty comical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In this, even though he is kind of slow and brutish, he is treated like the villain of the week, like a very... Yeah. Credible threat to Spider-Man and to the city, just like the Shocker and just like the Moon Rocks that, you know, give
John Jameson
powers. Like everything, all of that craziness, it's all in the same like plateau.
Well, I do like how they make the Rhino a very credible threat, to the point where even the scientists who are keeping him under are like, how are we going to keep him down?
We can't
tranquilize this guy. And they're like, just keep gassing him. Oh, but he's going to build up a tolerance. And oh my gosh, he's loose.
Which again is great.
I'm going to get that Spider-Man.
Yeah.
This is a weird volume too, because it's all about the first appearances. This is the transition point from Lee Ditko, but first appearance of Rhino, first appearance of Shocker.
Right.
Who, by the way, we need to talk about Shocker in a moment.
Yeah,
and
we'll get
first
to
appearance,
all.
Of course, of that girl.
Yeah, of Mary Jane.
What's
So Shocker comes in next. Well, we get a little bit with John Jameson gets all amped up on space spores and gains superpowers.
Yes, which happens. It's the Marvel Universe. You can get superpowers by riding the bus in the Marvel Universe. And then you get a quick bit with Lizard.
Oh, man, you get Daredevil and Foggy Nelson showing up in this. And I was like, whoa, you almost forget for a moment that everything is taking place. And even back in the 60s and in the 70s, mm-hmm. there was mm-hmm. a shared universe in place. I mean, yes, we had that with Fantastic Four and everything, but, you know, just this real quick cutaway to, hey, I'm Foggy Nelson. I'll be representing Rhino in court today. And, oh, my good friend Matt Murdock can't be here.
This is more than just shared universe. 1967, this is shared writer. Stan
writing. He's writing everything.
Daredevil. Yeah. Stan is writing Spider-Man. Stan is writing Avengers. So it's something where, you know, Stan is writing Marvel's 8 books per month. And he puts these little tie-in things, I think, to entertain himself.
He must.
You know, to keep from going crazy because he's literally writing 8 books a month. Mm-hmm.
Although you'd really think that this would just be a bad precedent to set, because we should have really gotten 6 pages mm-hmm. of why everybody in New York isn't getting involved. Like, it was like, well, I'll give him the first shot. And then, like, next panel, Reed Richards is like, I'm too busy working on the negative zone. It's like panel, like the Avengers are like, our card game's not done yet.
Yeah. Oh, let Spider-Man deal with it. He gave us the stink eye. We're not going to help him.
Exactly. And this is 67. The fascinating thing about this that you have to remember is this is still original 5 X-Men. These came out about the same time that the Mimic joined the X-Men. This is the point where Captain America, Quicksilver, the Scarlet Witch, and Hawkeye are the Avengers. That is the Avengers. A guy who runs real fast, his sister, and 2 guys who walk around. You know, we're not talking like Thor is flying through the universe and Iron Man is everywhere.
The Avengers are Captain America, Thor, Iron Man, Goliath, Wasp, and then Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch are out of the picture. They're off doing something important.
Doing something else.
And then, and I forget who the other member is.
Hawkeye,
yeah.
Yellow Jacket, probably.
Hawkeye is in that.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And that's the annual that's in this where they're all deciding whether Spider-Man should be in the Avengers or not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so they bring Spider-Man forward. And he's like, hey, you guys are going to make me an Avenger. This is great. Awesome. And they're like, yep, you got to do some tests. He's like, what the F, man? I'm Spider-Man. I'm like the first hero of the Marvel Universe. And they're like, no, that's technically the Fantastic Four. Shut up, man.
Yeah.
I'm Spider-Man. You want to fight?
Square.
And then they start fighting and punching. And then they're like, oh, so you know how to handle conflict well. Spider-Man, very good. We're going to put you through another test. Mm-hmm. Go track down the Hulk and bring him back to us because we don't want to catch him ourselves and get hurt. So Spider-Man goes and battles the Hulk. And the Hulk punches a hole in a gamma radiation containment area and turns back into Bruce Banner, Bruce Banner, which is really weird.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're having a conversation, and then Spider-Man, you know, the sad Hulk music starts coming up, and Spider-Man's like, I kind of feel sorry for Bruce Banner. I mean, here's mm-hmm. this guy that he doesn't even know that he can turn into a monster, and when he does, he's not even going to... Oh, there he goes. He turned into the Hulk again. Pow! Takes it down with one punch, right? And then he goes back, and he's like, yeah, you know what, guys? I don't want to be part of your stinking Avengers. See ya. I'm going to go ride my motorcycle and hook up with this hot Mary Jane girl.
That's a scooter, by the way. That is not a motorcycle.
You look at it, it's like...
You can call it a motorcycle all you want, Pete,
I wonder if that's even 50 cc's in that motorcycle.
Like
it really is.
He's riding a hair dryer.
It's a pretty thin motorcycle. It's not a beefed up one.
It's the coolest point. And this is the point, you know, Ditko left the series partly claiming, supposedly after the fact, people claim that they were making Peter too handsome and too cool and too normal.
Well, he does have those eyebrows and, you know, that haircut.
And yeah, now by this issue, he's this handsome guy on a motorcycle and he's got this hot redheaded love interest. And you can kind of see why one might have that concern.
Well, but not only that, I mean, here when we first join into this volume, Betty Brant is back and he's like, oh, Betty, you're like the greatest thing in the world. And then Ned comes in and she's like, oh, Ned, I've been thinking about you every single day. And Peter's like, yeah, I didn't want to talk to her anyway. Hey, Gwen, you want to go hang out? Oh, Peter, I'm having the party. Oh, Aunt May. I got to go do something for Aunt May. I can't, Gwen. Oh, that's okay, Peter. And, you know, then so you've got almost 3 women in Peter's lives in these, 9 issues that we've read here, 10 issues with the annual. And he's, you know, he gets rid of Betty pretty quickly, although she does pop up a couple more times. Well, she does pop up a lot more in this series because a lot of stuff happens at the Daily Bugle. Mm. Then we get Gwen. And then, of course, we get Mary Jane popping in. And then the thing that really struck me is, like, why is all this so familiar? It's because we read Spider-Man Blue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was amazing is how Loeb and Sale went to the source material mm-hmm. and really just retold. I mean, you don't have to read these modern classics unless you want to see some crazy Stanley hipster writing and some crazy Remita Sr. Artwork.
Yeah.
But if you read Spider-Man Blue, it covers everything in this bit and it changes it around just a little bit.
Yeah. Which on the one hand, yes, good for them for going back to the source material and being very truthful to it. On the other hand, you know, it's great that you can add a couple of things to a comic, yes. write the exact same thing that yes. happened and call it a new comic.
Yes,
like
exactly.
Reillustrated, basically.
Yeah. I mean, there was a couple of things like they made Kraven a little bit. I mean, Kraven pops up in this. They made Kraven a little bit bigger villain in mm-hmm. the in Spider-Man Blue. We get a little bit more reflection on some of these key elements, but
well, and Spider-Man Blue also takes place over a longer period of right. time. It's not just these
right,
issues.
Right. But I mean, all this stuff that we see, every yeah. interaction between Mary Jane, Gwen Stacy, and Peter Parker that are in these issues yes. are retold, all you know, definitely panel for panel in some cases.
Oh, yeah.
There are panels that, as I'm looking at this, I'm like, if I open up Spider-Man Blue right now, I can go right yeah. to this page and yep. this panel, and it'll yeah. be the same introduction really, where they all hang out at the coffee shop.
Really, that's what Spider-Man Blue does, is it does these stories but focuses on the relationship and does rewrite a few things. I mean, if you go from this, Gwen and Mary Jane had very little interaction. Mm-hmm. In Spider-Man Blue, they play up the love triangle a lot more strongly.
Yeah. Right. Did that bother yeah. you, though? I mean, you're kind of those that, I already read this once. Why am I reading it again?
No, although I had that exact same thing. I was like, this is really familiar. Yeah. Did we already read this? And then it was like, oh, this is Spider-Man Blue. It didn't bother me mostly because we'd done it so long ago. That's one. Two, I am doing this for a show.
Right.
It's not like I've never done comparative analysis before. So, like, mm-hmm. you know, major spoilers. I obviously approach it as a job or as I did actually a lot more seriously than I did school. Mm. So I was perfectly fine kind of thinking back and analyzing the differences. So no, it didn't bother me. I think if I was a new person and I was like, I'm going to read the best Spider-Man stuff, and somebody was like, oh, pick up this volume, and I was like, great. And somebody was like, oh, pick up Spider-Man Blue, and then I was like reading them. Then I would have been like, hey, you made me read the same story twice.
Well, and again, I think if you want to read some crazy Stan Lee dialogue and storytelling, and if you want to see some great Romita artwork, because I'm looking here at the first appearance of Mary Jane panel, and it's like, I want to blow that up mm-hmm. and hang it on the wall because it's so perfect. Now, there's other times where, like when he draws J.J. Jameson, and his eyes are yeah. whacked out, bugged out, yeah. and he just looks, and even the Rhino with his face is just distorted and crazy looking and not appealing. But you look at this one panel, and there are some other panels where you look at Mary Jane or Gwen, and their eyes are not correctly drawn in their heads a little bit, yeah. and it looks weird. Yeah. But this has got to be like the most perfect panel in the whole series besides the alley with the Spider-Man suit and the trash can.
Mm-hmm.
I love this artwork, but I mean, yeah, if you were duped into buying Blue and then told to buy this, I could see you being angry, but in this case,
nah.
What do you think of 60s Stan Lee writing there, Zach?
Oh man, is wacky on another level. What I honestly found the most interesting were the yellow text boxes throughout all this stuff
mm-hmm.
where yep.
editor's notes.
Well, not even the editor's notes, just like the voiceover between
the meanwhile.
Yeah.
10 minutes and 26 seconds later. Or
it
seemed, yeah,
it almost seemed like self-deprecating of like comics do this all the time. Watch us point out everything that we do all the time.
Yeah. Did you guys see the panel?
This is like when we talk about where things originate from, that's yeah. here, you know. And so when we make fun of it today, it's because of this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, but even and he felt like he thing. Was doing it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like, the thing about these issues is that it's not just, meanwhile, at Aunt May's house, Aunt May being Peter Parker, Spider-Man's aunt, it's like, yeah. listen, right. reader, we're going to show you this. It's not terribly relevant right now. We are recognizing that it's not very relevant. Yeah. But you're going to have to sit through us because this is a Spider-Man comic and we need to talk about mm-hmm. Aunt May.
It's like
really weirdly self-aware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, oh, I bet you're bored right now. Here's some action.
Yeah. But it's also Stan kind of reaching out to the reader and going, hey, we know you're in on the joke. We know that you get how a comic book works. This is me playing with it. My favorite part of this whole thing is there's a panel where they take Kurt Connors home to his family, and there's no dialogue in the panel, and Stan's yellow box says, knowing how talented our readers are, we're leaving this panel for you to write your own dialogue. And you can hear it in Rodrigo's Stan voice. He's like, and if you can get someone to play Hearts and Flowers softly in the background, it won't do a bit of harm. I love that tone, that, hey, cool guys, let's all have some fun, and I'm going to tell you an awesome story. The yellow boxes for me are always Stan Lee.
Yeah,
it's Stan telling me a story. Even after Stan leaves Marvel and they're still using the yellow boxes, I'm like, it's still Stan in my head.
I think someday when, when Stan Lee passes away, I think Marvel should just stop ceasing all of their comic book publishing. And the very last issue is, this old man in a bed somewhere with a snow globe sitting beside his table, and all of everything that we've been reading all this time has all been taking place in the mind of this old man in a hospital bed at St. Elysius.
Morbid.
He's like,
it's kind of stretch that out a little bit further, but this has all been taking place in his mind. This entire time. And so we've built this entire universe of things that are just coming out of Stan Lee's head, which is what they are right here. And you're right. This is Stan Lee's voice all throughout this. But I understand there's a lot of people that are going to read this and say, hey, daddy-o, go man, go hipster, wow. And people are going to say, I hate the dialogue in this piece. In fact, there's a comic coming up at the end of the show where one of our listeners is basically like, I don't like the dialogue.
It's interesting. There's always interesting word choices like daddy and stuff. The one that always throws me off, Aunt May. Oh, Peter, you're such a pussy willow. That one just throws me off all the time because I have no idea what she's even saying.
I don't know what it means. We have the Shocker. The Shocker is a man whose power is vibrating, and he has a big belt buckle with a V on it. And there's always been that theory, floating around fandom that Stan named this character the Vibrator before somebody went, Stan. But every word out of the Shocker's mouth, because now the name Shocker in some terms has a connotation.
Well, and then,
so now every word out of the character.
Yeah, let's just step aside and talk about that for just a moment. A lot of people know what the Shocker is, and yet Wichita State has made that their salute.
Wait, what?
Wichita State salute, and they promote the heck out of that, and it's like.
Like officially?
Yes.
Basketball games.
Wow.
Basketball
games
all over the place.
Wow.
They're throwing up the Shocker.
It's really amazing that on the one hand, Beaver College changed their name because they were tired of being made fun of. And on the other hand, literally on the other hand, Wichita goes basically doubles down on it.
What's really funny is to see the little old ladies in the crowd throwing the sign.
So you think they don't know, but I think they know.
I think they do.
Oh, I think they know too.
If they do, then good job, Wichita State. But on the other hand, if you guys are so out of it that you don't know that, and someone hasn't pulled you aside,
there's no way that hasn't happened.
I think there's a big foam hand.
Wow.
Because kids would tell a teacher would tell department head would move the chain.
They make it.
They don't care
because
it's funny.
Wow.
they make it into a W.
I had to explain that to one of our faculty a couple of years ago, and she's like, are you serious? I'm like, yes. And she's like, oh.
Yeah, I was one of the most naive kids growing up in high school, and I even knew that coming into college. That's what the thing was, and we still made fun of Wichita State.
But here's the thing. That is an example of exactly
what we're
seeing.
Yes, there's a giant foam hand.
When you talk about people saying there's too much dialogue, or this looks weird, or he's swinging cats saying daddy-o, that is an example of the context changing around the story.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, if you see a story with the Shocker in it these days, they are very aware of the fact that the man's name is the Shocker. And you can't change his name, and you can't deal with the fact that people think that maybe he was the Vibrator. I mean, there are a lot of things in here that haven't necessarily stayed relevant.
No, and I think
I
think that's the thing. Go forward 30 more years into the year of 2045.
The year 2000.
And I think people will look back at dialogue from the 90s, rad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and they're going to say,
what the hell are these people talking about?
Right. So if you opened up a comic book from the 80s or 90s in the year 2045, you're going to feel the same way that you do in 2045 as people reading this comic today. Mm-hmm. That language is so antiquated and feels so out of place.
But there's a difference between because some books will just use it naturally.
Right.
Right. Somebody will just be like, oh, that's rad,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And then later on when you read it, you're like, oh, haha, people said rad back then. Yeah, or you can say, like, you can even take it as, oh, this person is being ironic, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. as like, oh, that's totally gnarly,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a funny and ironic way. But Mary Jane just goes crazy with it. Okay. Like, it's very clear that this is a guy who in the 60s, I'm going to guess, was already 40. Probably not, but that's what he comes across as.
Yeah, probably 35, 40, yeah.
Trying to be hip like the kids, and it just comes across totally weird. It was the same thing with, like, Kirby when we read that run of Jimmy Olsen. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
That run of Jimmy Olsen where, like, it's like Superman having trouble connected to the young generation,
mm-hmm.
and they talk like... Mm-hmm. Like cartoon beatniks.
Well, but notice that it's only Mary Jane doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that Mary Jane wants to be an actress and wants to be a model, she would she would be one that would be using that language more because that is the current trend. It's kind of like when Zach starts going off about all of his hipster music groups. And we're just kind of like, yeah, okay, whatever, Zach.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of that way here. She's pushing her language to the extreme to say, hey, I'm with it. I'm together. I'm part of the here and the now. And you need to pay attention to me.
Right.
And I'm going to be the star. And I'm going to be really important.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't see Peter doing that. You don't see Gwen doing that. You don't see Flash doing that. You mm-hmm. don't see the Rhino doing that.
Right.
So yeah. I think it's intentional, not just Stanley going, hey, I want to be young like you
kids.
I think he's intentionally putting it on this character to give her a little bit more depth than maybe what people give her credit for.
To make her topical, which I think
topical
is really
relevant for
in 1967, Stan Lee would have been 45.
Right.
All remarks about 45-year-old men being old are suspended at this time. And I think I can get Stephen's approval on that.
No, I mean, I think 45 is older.
Well, 45 is not a kid.
No, it's not a kid. 45
is not a teenager.
It's not 20. It's not 19. It's not 18.
That's the thing.
It's not 21.
But
I mean, Peter's got to be going to college, so he's 19 in this series.
If you read this book, and again, I'm the guy, you know, I'm looking at the historical perspective. On this week, actually, I reviewed a comic from 1967, and it was a god-awful topical train wreck mess. I mean, it was bad. If you look at the stuff that was coming out in 67, even though you have your Gwen doing her Gwen thing, 67 was the year of the real campy Batman stuff with the Eraser, who had the ability to erase people. And even the Joker being kind of a wild beatnik talking guy. I mean, this is dated in a way, I'd say.
Yeah.
But it's also dated in a way that works. It feels less like, my God, this is old, and more like a successful period piece for me. This isn't like the Citizen Kane of comics, but it might.
No, but even
you can probably make a case for it as the Magnificent Ambersons of comics, where it's, you know.
No,
it's a period piece.
Even
it's
Citizen
tied
Kane,
to a time frame.
Citizen Kane is the same way. It's tied to a time period, and it's definitely a dated piece. And I think that's when you look at books like this, and if you're going to go in and read historical works, and historical works could be Charles Dickens, it could be Stan Lee and Romita Sr., whatever. I think part of your analysis of a book or enjoyment of a book has to come with the knowledge of, I'm reading this through the lens of that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And if I understand what's going on in that time period, I'll have a better of appreciation of why they approached this piece. For those of you that listened, was it a couple of weeks ago when we did the Star Wars class postmortem, and we were talking about racism in Star Wars and how it was not intended racism, but it was a consequence of that specific time period in which the first Star Wars movie was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it through that way, I'm not saying it makes it right, but it gives you a better perspective on the hows and the whys.
Right,
and if you think about what's going on with Peter, and we're joking that that's not a real motorcycle, to Peter it's a real motorcycle. And to people around him, they see that as a real motorcycle. Yet in this era of Suzuki's and Harley Davidson's, we look at that and go, well, that's a moped.
Yeah.
Right. But I think if you look at it from that perspective, you get a better understanding of what's going on with everybody.
Did you guys catch in the last issue Jonah Jameson's appearance with Ed and Johnny on The Tonight Show?
Yes. Yes.
Which that was, to me, I'm looking at that and I'm like, why does that character look familiar? And I realize they have brown hair. It's 1967. They're not the white-haired hosts that I grew up with, but it's still Ed and Johnny. And they don't mention it. They don't name them, but it is very clearly Ed and Johnny. And I'm like, that to me kind of explains what Stan Lee would do with his most successful work, is he would tie it to things that people knew.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was topical in the best way.
And by the way, I will say one thing that is great about the writing in this is that Peter Parker totally reads like a teenage boy.
Mm-hmm.
He really does. Yeah. There's a great scene where he's like, either he's trying to get to sleep or trying to do homework, and he's like, Mary Jane, where's Stacy? My new bike, Spider-Man stuff. Oh, I can't get to sleep. Like, it's just such a great moment of him just having so much stuff going on in his brain. Like, it's just all this stuff. Like, he's just, like, completely sad a lot of the time. He's like, oh, Aunt May got sick, and I didn't do anything about it. And it's like, well, even if you weren't Spider-Man, you wouldn't necessarily know how to treat an old lady.
Right.
Uh-huh. Like, but it's such a kid thing to be like, oh, this is all my fault.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, and that leads to the very famous, again, a second famous panel in this arc, is with the Spider-Man costume in the trash can and Peter walking away in the rain, and this is the end of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Which is issue 50, which is the culminating issue in this collection. Yeah. And you can kind of feel for the kid. It's like, oh, all because I'm Spider-Man, I can't take care of my aunt, and she can't afford pills. And here I went and spent all this money on a motorcycle instead of taking care of her. What kind of adopted son
jerk
am I?
Jerk face jerk.
Yeah, what a jerky jerk am I? And then, of course, Jonah.
Well, yeah. And we've seen this sequence in the Raimi Spider movies.
Yeah, played out exactly.
And but it works so much better here with 5 years of story behind it than it does with, 45 minutes. Because in the movie, it kind of feels like Peter is being an indecisive jerk. Whereas here in the comic, it's clear that Peter is totally being an indecisive jerk. Because after months and months of being Spider-Man, since he's like, 15, he hears and listens to this television program. And he's like, maybe I am a jerk. Maybe I am a menace. Oh, my God, what have I done?
Yeah.
Another, perfect teenage boy moment where you're like, you're 18 and you're going to put away childish things, even if you do have superpowers. But I'm looking at this and I swear to you on my honor as a comic book nerd, there is Gil Kane artwork in these pages.
Well, that's why, that's why at first I thought it was Ditko, because, I don't remember Romita keeping the underwebbing in a couple of
41. The first appearance of the Rhino is very clearly Romita no, drawing.
Yeah, I mean,
as
you go through it.
Ditko,
yeah, maybe
pastiche.
That's what it is. Maybe that's what
well,
it is.
But that's
he's doing Ditko to transition, I think.
Yeah.
And
because I want to say that may be his first or one of his earliest issues on the book. What did Ditko do? 40 issues?
I was looking up. I was trying to look up some of that stuff while you were talking. And when Ditko came on.
Ditko, I know he did. Well, 33 is that big, oh my God, lifting a machine on your back issue. So he got that far.
Okay.
I think he got to like 38, 39. But yeah, that 41 is very clearly a transitional issue where Romita is doing a total Ditko riff. And you can see it in the Rhino's design.
Mm-hmm.
You can see it in his Peter Parker faces.
Mm-hmm.
As you transition through this, three or four issues later, the first appearance of the Shocker.
Right.
From 41 to 46, you can see a complete difference in the way Romita is approaching the art, approaching Aunt May, approaching Pete. And I think that when you talk about that wonderful moment where we first meet Mary Jane, that I think feels like the moment where John Romita gets his feet underneath him and says, all right, this is my book now.
And
this is now going forward.
And there's something about that Romita look when it comes to ladies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And even though they're very similar, they're also very different from one another, because I was trying to look at Gwen compared to Mary Jane.
Yeah, and
Mary
Jane, they don't have the same face. They kind of have the same
It's like their features are the same.
Kind of, but Mary Jane has a bigger bosom and a tinier waist than Gwen does.
Well, and their faces are different. There are differences to their faces. It's like he's using like the same collection of pieces, but arranging them differently enough.
Like color forms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Zach wouldn't know what those are. But.
But yeah, and he's doing that really well to the point where if you look at a page of Gwen and a page of Mary Jane in black and white, which, you know, some of us have, you can look at that and you can tell this is meant to be Mary Jane and this is meant to be Gwen.
Right.
Without the color, without, you know, the red hair to tell you what's going on. And I think that right there, you know, that's pretty impressive if you look at these.
So Ditko left after issue 38 and Romita replaced him as penciler until
39.
Well, it says, following Ditko's departure after 38, Romita replaced him as penciler, so that would be 39. And it says, for the next several years, and it doesn't say when. But this has always been, well, except for Amazing Fantasy, this has always been Amazing Spider-Man. So we are, I mean, how many issues a year are being printed of this? Are there 10 issues a year, 12 issues a year? Is it coming out monthly? 9 issues a year?
9.
So by the time we get here, that's, you know, that's 4 or 5 years worth of stuff. Backing this up. So that's still pretty incredible because it seems so young. It seems so young when numbering comes into play. You know, it's issue 40 and all these big things are happening. And yet this is stuff that's happened years after Spider-Man's been around. And it's so in this day and age where Spider-Man's being printed, three, 4 times a month.
Well, I mean, they got first 30 issues of Superior Spider-Man in 1 year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The first 65 issues of this book are full of changes. Peter goes through 2 years of high school, gets into college. You know, by issue 100, Peter Parker has gone from being 16 to being almost 20. The early days of the Marvel Universe are full of change and time and things that really differentiated it from the books of the time. You know, your Superman, your Batman, your Wonder Woman were pretty much unchanging icons by 1967 because they were 40 years old. But if you look at these first, you know, 104 issues of Fantastic Four, the first 75 issues of Spider-Man, it's all about change. It's all about things change at the drop of a hat.
And just the introduction of these characters 4 or 5 years into it.
Yeah.
I thought this was time well spent, even though it's very wordy throughout the piece. I thought this was time well spent.
I think part of the appeal in this, you can tell there's something that is like burning at the center of Spider-Man that Stan Lee is writing. Stan Lee is generating content. He's like getting to things that he wants to do and talk about. And if time gets in the way and if like telling an easy story gets in the way, he just skips it or breaks through it or does something else. There's like he's writing Peter Parker's story. And yeah, it's like, oh, well, he needs to be in college now. I want to do college stuff. Boom. He's in college.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, there's no status quo. Characters are introduced. Characters go away kind of normally in the way that a person's life does. He's more interested in writing Spider-Man's story than in all the action. And he's apologetic about it, but kind of only in a very tongue-in-cheek way because When we see those panels where he's like, oh, I know you came to see Spider-Man, but we were going to talk about Aunt May, that's him kind of being like apologizing for it. But those panels are relevant because that's where the introduction of Mary Jane is.
Mm-hmm.
So or of the concept of Mary Jane. Yeah. So
it's like 6 issues before we see her.
Like the thing is like he's basically going, I know you're used to crap, but I'm actually going to give you a good, solid story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's what's amazing. You could think that this could be very schlocky and very cheesy, but there's good stuff here. And I really seriously want to go back and buy all the other Masterworks. And again, we're reading these in a digital version from Comixology, but I really want to see this stuff. And you know, the Avengers, the very first issue of the Avengers, not that good. Not a very good book.
First 25 issues of Avengers, not really that
but
good.
This is something that was interesting. And if this is how all the previous stuff was, man, I want to get into this.
Well, and you can see why Spider-Man was like an ongoing like newspaper comic.
Yeah, and you can see where, and then the reason why I picked this up is because I knew it had the first appearance of the Rhino, and with the Amazing Spider-Man 2 movie coming out, I was like, let's, you know, this should maybe somehow tie into it. And it does in a lot of ways. gives us insight into what's going on into Spider-Man. And and it's odd, too, that all the Spider-Man movies that we've seen all are taking place in these like first 100 issues of Spider-Man.
Yeah, that was what was weird to me is like, oh, this is from Spider-Man 3. And this is from Spider-Man 1. This is from Amazing Spider-Man 1. All these moments like, oh, this is from this huge
not just the Spider-Man movies, but basically 100% of all Spider-Man cartoons.
Yes.
Too. Right. Anything, any derivative work comes out of this issue.
Yeah, the first 100 issues probably,
You have to take something into account. These days, comic books as we know them in the year 2014 exist because of Marvel. Marvel's plotting became plotting. And when you say Marvel plotting, the reason Marvel became Marvel was this book, Amazing Spider-Man. So in a way, Amazing Spider-Man is comics in the year 2014. And if you look at this, this is a series of books that has the first appearance of the Kingpin, first appearance of the Rhino, first appearance of the Shocker, first appearance of the second Vulture, who doesn't stick around. But this is the first appearance of a lot of characters. But what is important about this run, the first appearance of an 18-year-old girl, this is Stan Lee subverting comics. Because if you look at this, this is not a run of, oh, look, here's the Rhino and the Rhino is awesome. Oh, look, here's the Kingpin and the Kingpin is awesome. These are the people that Peter has to deal with. And here's the most important woman in his life, depending on, you know, whether or not your Joe Quesada arguing it. Right. This is an important series of books because this really sets the tone for Marvel style. Marvel style sets the tone for comics as we know them. And after about 1970, when Spider-Man starts to slow down and there's not so much change anymore, this is really where Spider-Man starts to freeze in amber. Yeah. Because as he gets into college and starts getting into, you know, this is the point where he is now in our books.
Yeah.
He's not much more than a year or two past these stories in our current continuity in the minds of the writers. This is where Spider-Man came from. These are the Spider-Man stories that everybody wants to tell over and over and over. And also sometimes throw in Venom because people like Venom.
I say pick up this collected work. You will enjoy it regardless if you've read Spider-Man Blue or not. Rodrigo?
It's historically important. If you want to understand where Spider-Man comes from, and especially where cartoon, movie, and video game Spider-Man comes from, if that's what you're into, if that's how you approach the character, you need to read these issues to see where all that stuff come from. Mm-hmm. Steven was right. There's two very important moments. Neither one involves punching the Rhino in the face.
Right.
There's the introduction of a girl, like Matthew said, and that panel that has been spoofed over and over and over again of Spider-Man walking away from his thing on a trash can, which, like, literally, I am looking right now. Steven just has a random pile of comics. And there is a spoof of it at the very top of it.
On which one? The bottom box?
The 2000 AD comic. It's like Judge Dredd is walking away from his uniform.
How about that?
Like,
2000 AD, this
randomly,
comic book day.
Totally not planned, right there. You will see this panel over and over and over again. It's just like, this is that panel. This is like Cyclops with like a bag over his shoulder walking away from his friends. Or like the X-Men busting through the cover. Like, this is one of those images that you will see, at least in Marvel comics, into eternity.
Yeah, that one with Cable standing on the cover. Yeah. Zach, what are your final thoughts on this?
I really enjoyed this. If I recommend it, I would say if you like Spider-Man at all, you should pick this up without a doubt and buy it. My recommendation is, if you're most used to more modern comics, is take it slow. I kind of jumped in this with 2 feet and kind of just had to burn through all of them. I got a little burnt out because I'm not used to the,
it's very wordy.
I mean, just the style of story.
You got to pace yourself.
As being told them. Yeah. But it's completely worth it. Really, you could almost take out all the fighting, and this would be still some
good
of
drama.
The best like Spider-Man comics I've
read. Why can't they make teenage drama TV like this?
Well, partially
they do.
Because
it's called One Tree Hill.
Yeah. Partially, Spider-Man kind of already did it. But but you get into there is good teenage drama to write with superheroes, but the problem is that the formula is in effect. Right. Back in these days, nobody could stop Stan Lee.
Right.
Nowadays, partially because of this work, is that we have those formulas. And they're difficult to break away from.
Yeah. Matthew, final thoughts?
There are going to be people who are like, this is too wordy. I don't understand it. This is all 60s and I don't like it. That's perfectly legitimate. But this is where in a lot of ways, modern comics come from. And if you say to me, you know, I'm a fan of Spider-Man, I behoove you. No, it behooves you. I implore you to check this book out, because this is where Spider-Man really kind of crystallizes into the Spider-Man that we know. And this is where some of the best stuff in the Marvel Universe happens. And you get John Romita drawing Gwen Stacy. You get John Romita drawing, you know, that shot, that cover shot of John Jameson punching Spider-Man with the big moon boots and that's incredible. Love every issue of this set. You definitely need to read it. And if you tell me that, well, it's too old for me, I'm going to go, okay, that is a perfectly legitimate thing.
If you went and saw saw any of the Spider-Man movies, you're reading you're watching these issues.
Yes. Yeah. This is it. This is the thing. This is the point.
All right, everybody. That wraps it up for this issue. Thank you for listening and being part of the Major Spoilers experience. Please share this show with a friend. If you enjoyed it, let people know. I know someone was saying today, Steven, you had me laughing out loud in the office and people are looking at me weird. Well, next time they look at you weird, just go, hey, it's Critical Hit, or hey, this is a Dueling Review, or whatever it is. And say, if you want a good laugh, or you want to be educated or whatever, take a listen. Share it with somebody. Share this experience. Comics are really, even though they are a singular read, it is a shared experience because we're all reading these and we can all talk about them. And if this gets more people talking about comics, if it gets more people interested in this this pop culture world that we're studying, my gosh, share the show with a friend. Let's get people out there and get more people on board. I was at the movie theater the other day, and what are they selling there in the movie theater now? Smartest move they could have ever done.
T-shirts.
They're selling superhero-related T-shirts with the movies that are going on. They need to go and buy some little standees that say, hey, if you want to learn more about the X-Men you want to go and read Days of Future Past, here's a Comixology code that you could use to go and read the comic that was that inspired this movie. Now, granted, it's not the exact same story.
Not even close.
But
here's a story that has the same name.
Get more people talking. That's what we need. More people talking. And we're going to be back next week answering your questions. Why? Because we know that you love comics. We do too. And we will talk with you soon. Ooh, Spider-Man, I'm going to give you such a pinch.
Greetings and salutations, Major Spoilers. This is JR, better known as Hip Hop Head in the forum when I go to the forum. Anyway, going along with Amazing Spider-Man, I just finished reading number 43 as a part of that masterworks of Spider-Man. Fighting the Rhino. I commented on Stan Lee in my last phone call. Stan Lee was trying to be so hip with the lingo, the introduction of Mary Jane and the way she was talking like a hip go-go hippie from the 60s girl. Well, I guess the time was the 60s, but it just seems... kind of out of place to read her talking with that type of voice as opposed to how she was in, let's say, the last 10, 15 years and how she was portrayed. But the origin of the Rhino was kind of funny. The unknown or undefined doctors deciding to give him this strength which increased his intelligence, yet didn't show itself when he was fighting that he was smart. He was rather stupid when it came to fighting Spider-Man. But it was worth the 12 cents back in 1965 or 68, whenever this book came out, to read this story of Peter Parker. And that's another aspect of the early, I guess what made Spider-Man so interesting is that it gave him a real person's life with real person issues, which a lot of folks could relate to. There's reference to the draft in this issue. A running theme is Peter wanting to get his own place to live in so he doesn't have to live with his aunt, his aunt being old and frail, and him having to feel obligated to take care of her and not being able to leave her, girl problems with having a crush on Gwen Stacy, but you can't, or his inability to talk to her. And then when he meets Mary Jane, he like almost forgets about Gwen. He's focused on Mary Jane. And, you know, I don't know about that Parker luck. I mean, he has pretty good luck when it comes to getting the ladies. If he dumped that costume, he might be able to keep them ladies. But that Parker luck, I wish I had it, had it back in the day to at least pull some of the finer redhead and blondes that were out there. But I'm looking forward to reading this these next few issues, which lead into the Lizard and Kraven the Hunter and the Vulture, and then the Spider-Man No More, which led to the Captain America No More and the Iron Man No More and the Daredevil No More. I think this may have been one of the first No More books ever. So love the show, guys. My other comment regarding the poll of the week. I was the one that emailed you, Schleicher, that couldn't find where I could leave my comments. And that's because you guys update the page so fast. I guess the poll comments move off quick. It could be possible for you to have a link to where the poll is on the side so we could leave, or at least, you know, link to where the comment page is as opposed to trying to have to find it. But that's a very minor issue. I love the poll of the week. I love the question of the day. Zach on film. The want list. Not in the critical hits. You know, I guess I have to understand those board games that I never played. But overall, I love the pop culture. Matthew's knowledge of the history of comics amazes me. He just, off the top of his head, comes up with this information. Walking encyclopedia, I guess. Until next time, have a good day, guys.
Hello there. This is Slappy calling, and I wish to speak to Zach specifically with regards to The Godfather. Now, you missed, or rather, some things that were not necessarily touched on in the Godfather podcast happen to be the fact that Talia Shire is the sister of Francis Ford Coppola, and that Nicholas Coppola, who did the music, is also a relative. And he went after his family to bring in different things for this particular movie. So it really was indeed a family affair. And then, unfortunately, if you want to consider three, he ended up having his daughter, Sofia Coppola, in there, as she was also in the first Godfather, but as a different character, in the original Godfather film. Francis Ford Coppola actually filmed his daughter being baptized. Sofia was baptized, and that is the baby being baptized during that particular scene in The Godfather. Now, when you were referring to the parody of the film, I think one of the best versions of parody, in my opinion, and one I really enjoyed, is the movie entitled The Freshman, starring Matthew Broderick and Marlon Brando, where Marlon Brando, of course, plays a Vito Corleone-type person who goes on his own Vito Corleone riff as, I believe it's Jimmy the Toucan. And that one, definitely worth a watch, especially since it does play around with the tropes, but in a different direction with what you see in The Godfather. Now, with regards to the movie that Zach has not seen, I know Matthew loves Head, and I think Zach needs to be exposed to Head as well. So if you can get Head for Zach, that would be great, and I know Matthew would be pleased with it as well. We all need some more monkeys in our life. Slappy out.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you have questions or comments, feel free to send an email to podcast@majorspoilers.com. You can follow Major Spoilers on Twitter, @MajorSpoilers. Like us on Facebook and share your thoughts about comic books and pop culture by using the comment section on any post at majorspoilers.com.
Fat Dick's revision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven rich like a man of iron, I might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart gold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being the middle east with a king, son, throwing soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
Major Spoilers is copyright 2014.